You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, thanks for joining us today. I am Lindsay Ehrens. Let's go inside Utah politics. So we begin our program with Utah Senator Mike Lee pushing back on critics of his proposal to sell off public lands to fund the federal government in the Big Beautiful Bill. Now, under the plan, the BLM and U.S. Forest Service would be required to sell off land across the country. Now, supporters of the bill say this will help develop affordable housing. But the plan has been met with backlash from environmental groups. But Lee says they're exaggerating the impact of the bill and the changes that could be coming.
Any of the 15 categories, it's not even eligible for this. And they're working on changes to further limit eligible lands to those Forest Service-owned lands within 2 miles of a population center, and lands managed by the Bureau of Land Management within 5 miles of a population center. So this deals with land that is only in or near a place where people live, and it doesn't authorize the sale. It authorizes a process whereby it could be considered for that purpose.
Well, you heard it there from the senator himself. Now, we also expect the bill could get a vote in the Senate next week. But I'm joined today by Devin O'Day. He's the Western Policy and Conservation Manager at Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. Devin, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so let's dive right in. You heard there from Senator Lee that he says provisions are coming that are going to change this so that land has to be close proximity to population centers. Does that assuage any fears for you on this potential sale?
You know, I'm glad to hear that there's changes coming. I think that there has been a huge amount of opposition from public landowners all over the nation. And, you know, it's obvious that the senator is hearing that. Regardless of what those changes are, it's our opinion that the budget reconciliation process is not the place to be selling public lands. There's an established process that was, voted on by Congress that had, stakeholder input through the Federal Land Policy and Management Act. And that's the process that we want to see any type of public land sales considered, not through budget reconciliation, and not where we're going to be bypassing some of the existing laws that take those sales of public lands and reinvest them back into conservation or access for the public.
Yeah, some of the pushback to that I've heard is more just that that process takes a decade sometimes. We know the federal government doesn't move quickly. I mean, is this a way to kind of speed up that process?
This is definitely an expedited attempt to sell public lands. And, I think that this is a very serious thing, and we want to have community input. We don't want to be rushing this through without that stakeholder engagement, because once these lands are sold, they're gone. And they're gone forever. And there's an incredible amount of value to hunters, anglers, but also just people that like to recreate, camp, hike, explore on public lands. So it's not something that should be rushed.
Can you walk us through a little bit of your concerns just overall with the provision, with this proposal? Is it just public land sale, period, full stop?
No, there's going to be times where there are parcels that, might need to be sold off. And so we're not drawing a hard line in the sand that no public land can ever be sold. What we are saying is that the latest draft from the senator includes a huge acreage of lands. While there are certain exemptions for lands that are federally protected, the most recent draft has about 250 million acres that could be sold, that would be eligible to be sold. And then the way the bill is structured, 2 to 3 million acres of those would be mandated to be sold in an expedited timeline. And while there's a deference to states to have first right of refusal, there's really very limited safeguards. This isn't affordable housing. There's pretty broad definitions there, which raise a lot of concerns for us on, what problem are we really solving, and what are those impacts going to be to the local communities that have relied on these lands for generations?
Yeah, so on that housing piece, that is the big defense of the senator, right, is that we need some of this land, especially this land that butts up against our cities or even within existing city limits, needs to be for affordable housing. Our cities, especially in Utah, are growing, especially in the south and southeast and southwest of our state. How do we fix this housing crisis if we have this land that can't be used for that purpose?
Well, I think what we need to do is we need to get, you know, targeted. And the senators that want to solve this crisis, we need to be looking at these particular parcels. We need to be showing these maps, identifying the habitat values, the existing recreation value, what type of connections they have to the broader outdoor economy, and laying it all out on the table and looking at exactly which parcels make the most sense, doing that through either the federal agency resource management planning process or, broad stakeholder input, and then moving that forward in the established processes that we have to, I think there's going to be community support if we move it that way. If we take, 250 million acres and say it could be any of these, and we're going to mandate that we sell at least 3 million and none of that money gets reinvested into conservation or access for local communities, certainly there's going to be a big backlash. I think that's what we've seen, and we've seen more engagement on this issue than really any prior issue for our communities. And I think that's indicative of the fact that there's a lot of opposition to this really broad brush attempt to solve this problem.
You represent hunters and anglers. So how do the hunters and anglers feel about some of these lands? If these lands are so close to cities that they're not maybe, taking over some of those big open spaces or, the rivers where y'all fish, forgive me for not totally knowing all of those spots, but are there still concerns with this provision among the hunters and anglers?
Yeah, I mean, I think I haven't seen any provision from the senator yet that includes any of those safeguards. So all I can operate off of is the most recent draft, which doesn't have any of those safeguards. Assuming that there were additional restrictions put in place regarding proximity to cities and any of those definitions, I still think there's a number of areas where you can be within, 2 to 5 miles of a city and have really valuable outdoor recreation, hunting and angling experiences. And so I think that, again, it's not just a matter of proximity. I think what we need to do is we need to be looking at, is there a mule deer migration corridor that happens to go through this city? What are the existing values? Like, what does that community use look like? And then work backwards to those lands that don't have that same value. They don't have those communities that are going to stand up and oppose this. And I think that's how we are going to arrive at the solution. It can't just be a mathematical formula, which is how this bill's been written thus far.
There's obviously way more public land in the West than there is in the East, right? Our friends back East don't really deal with these public lands issues as much, right? Because we have so much of our land federally controlled here in Utah. How do you feel like Congress needs to work together to kind of broach this subject with different states having so many different needs?
Yeah, and I think, the beauty of our federal lands is that, that anyone can use them. They belong to all of us. So even though I don't live in some of the states, I don't live in Utah personally, but I love to recreate on those lands because, I have an interest. I'm a stakeholder to those lands. And so I think that the way we solve this is not by looking, state by state, but by recognizing that these are an asset to all of the American people. And one of the most beautiful things about our country is the fact that we can go explore and we can go across different states and hunt and fish and camp with our families in all these different landscapes. And that's what makes America great.
What have you done? Have you done anything to reach out, work with the senator on this to try to get this proposal in a place that you like? And he has said this morning that he thinks it is pretty likely that this, I think he said very likely, this thing will pass. What happens if it does? And are you working with him at all to try and get some of your concerns addressed?
Yeah, we are absolutely of the perspective we would love to work with every senator, every representative to advocate for, those lands that have value to hunters and anglers and for wildlife and for habitat. We're going to always have that door open for a conversation. We're going to continue to emphasize that those lands that are important to our community, we really don't want to see sold. And we would be glad to work through any type of proposals. But again, the budget reconciliation process is one that cuts out the public, and it circumvents all these established laws that were built for the intent purpose of dealing with this issue. And there's a lot of thought that went into them. And this rushed process that's not bipartisan, that doesn't have public input, it can't be the answer.
We'll have to leave it there. Devin Odie with Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, I appreciate your time today and sharing your thoughts on your opposition to this bill. Obviously, we'll have to see where it goes from here, but thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, still ahead here on Inside Utah Politics, Salt Lake City Police briefing lawmakers on a deadly shooting, what we know about the No Kings protest shooting, and what questions still remain. That's next.
You're listening to Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ehrens.
Well, welcome back. Utah lawmakers still looking for answers on the deadly shooting at the Salt Lake City No Kings protest. Salt Lake City Police Chief Brian Redd summoned to Capitol Hill to brief them on the latest information at the Capitol this week. Now, we know a peacekeeper with the protest shot an armed man, injuring him and killing 39-year-old Afa Alu, who was an innocent bystander. Now, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle tell us that while they still have serious questions, they have faith in the Salt Lake City Police Department.
To be honest, I was hoping to get more details. I'm 100% confident in Salt Lake City's Police Department. I really am.
I'm confident he'll get us to the place where they're going to answer all those questions that we have.
Now, in the meantime, one man is in custody, Arturo Gamboa. He stands accused of approaching the march and aiming his rifle at protesters. Well, I'm joined today by Representative Jeff Burton. He was one of the lawmakers briefed by SLCPD. Rep. Burton, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
Okay, so just talk to me about what you got from that briefing from Chief Redd.
Well, obviously, and as I've said, we're not going to talk about an ongoing investigation. I do, like the speaker, have complete trust in Chief Brian Redd. I've worked with him previously when he took over the Utah Department of Corrections, and he's an amazing leader. He's very much dedicated to his officers, and I think you're going to see some amazing things at the Salt Lake City Police Department. He is on this. They're taking it very seriously. It's a complex problem, obviously, when you have potentially people on both sides who could be armed at some of these events. And obviously what we're focusing on is peaceful opportunity to protest without feeling like you're gonna get hurt if you go to one of these events. And so it is concerning to us, and we'll stay tuned. But I can tell you from a character perspective, we have a lot of trust in Brian Redd to lead this investigation in a proper way.
Were you satisfied with the answers you got? Chief Redd was kind of summoned to Capitol Hill, if you will. Were you satisfied with the answers you got?
Yeah, I'm satisfied. I think he's on track doing the right things. He's a very skilled investigator. Having been a military police investigator, I understand the nuances and the complexities of a situation like that. And I think Brian's all over it. He's going to give us an honest look and make sure that, I mean, to him, the safety of the citizens of Salt Lake City is paramount, and that's what we all want.
Well, I want to dive into the issue a little bit, which is we had a peacekeeper there that organizers say was a part of their group to ostensibly help keep the peace, but it's their shots that ultimately killed an innocent bystander. I mean, from a legal perspective, even, we just have a situation where a man is dead, but the person who fired the shots wasn't necessarily aiming at him. So with your legal and military training and background, I mean, just what do you make of the questions that need to be answered here?
Well, let's be clear. These peacekeepers have no affiliation with the Salt Lake City Police Department, and likely no coordination. So it would be errant for me to talk in detail about anything because I don't know anything at this point. I have trust in the investigators. But again, it's complex when you have people on both sides of the issue that have anger. I am convinced that we're going to get to the truth here and that justice will be served. But again, as I've said, this is an investigation. Much of the information I don't have. What I do have is confidence in the people conducting it. So,
do you think there will be more charges coming?
It's possible as they dig into this. But again, the challenge we face is that when these people bring firearms to events like this and there's no coordination, anything can happen, and it's a volatile mix. And so knowing that the Salt Lake City Police Department and the Department of Public Safety were there in force, I have complete faith that the truth will be found. And I hope that through the answers, we can learn how to coexist with people who disagree on political issues. We do believe it's a fundamental principle that people can have, the opportunity to express their opinion in a public forum, but they should be safe while they're doing that. And so this is not being taken lightly. It's a serious matter.
Should the group have brought their own peacekeepers with them? Because this peacekeeper, according to the group, had a military training and a military background. But again, we have an innocent bystander who lost his life because of it. Should that have been something they were coordinating with police? Or how do you see that whole security issue?
Yeah, I mean, the bottom line is this event is going to cause a lot of questions to be asked and a lot of answers to be found. And It's easy to Monday morning quarterback situations, but again, while they're investigating it, I'm not going to talk about the details. I think what you will find is that some answers will come out and maybe some new tactics, techniques, and procedures for dealing with situations like this.
Interesting. Kay, we'll have to watch to get all of those questions answered. I know there's still a lot of them. I want to switch to another topic because you are the chair of the Government Operations Interim Committee, which met this week to kind of hash out some issues. And signature gathering is one hot topic these days, as we've seen some issues in the 2024 primary. And we have some accusations that are still lingering out there. So your committee is really looking at changing some processes for signature gathering, and namely committee bill. One of those, a committee bill, for those who don't know, is just a bill that becomes a priority for your committee and may skip later committees once it gets to the session. But it would require that the names of people who sign those petitions for candidates to get on the ballot now become public. Right now, they're not public. Is that a good idea? Do you like that idea? Where do you think that bill goes?
Yeah, I mean, the purpose of these interim committees is to field ideas and to, find answers, really get into the depth and dive deep into these issues. So one of the challenges, as you mentioned at the beginning, was we have accusations still about the validity and the appropriateness of some of the signature collection. We want to dive into that and find out how we can improve that process. And what we're talking about here is candidate signature drives, petitions to get on the ballot.
Right.
As you know, that has been put into place by Senate Bill 54 because of issues at the conventions in the past, candidates not being able to get to the ballot. And so that's even being debated, whether you should be able to do signatures. And unfortunately, some of those that collected signatures weren't necessarily very clean in the way that they did it. And that's why we had that on the list. One of the items discussed was making it public when you sign one of these petitions. That is something that we debated last session and didn't really get resolved. And so that's why it's on the issue now. I'm not sure what I think of that yet. Mm. Personally, I've signed many petitions, and I don't mind if my name is out for public view. We believe that anything that's done from a political standpoint should probably be available to the public to see. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to have community comment. We're going to take a lot of input from people across the state to decide what we really think about that, because those bills will probably see the light of day when the next session comes.
Yeah. What major signature changes, are there any that you see are low-hanging fruit, glaring? I know we made some changes in the last session with one bill in particular, but are there any low-hanging fruit and glaring changes with signature gathering you think need to happen?
Yeah, number one, we need to make sure that the companies that are gathering signatures, when you're talking about a governor's race, there are a lot of signatures required. And so hiring outside organizations to get your signatures is a fairly common thing. I think that by prosecuting some of these obvious issues with signature collection, some of these companies that don't do it right, it's going to get the attention and improve the process. Secondly, you mentioned House Bill 300 did add the last four of your driver's license or some state or federal ID to the voting process. We've always known that signatures are not really a reliable way of determining who somebody is. Signatures are not ID. we're going to be using them as a secondary method to validate that you are the proper voter. But that ID is probably the more important aspect. So we are looking for ways to diminish the importance of signatures because they're so subjective. And one of the things we found in our investigation thus far is there were a lot of signatures that were invalidated that should not have been, and then there were a lot of signatures that were validated that should not have been. And that is because of the subjectivity of looking at a signature. You can look at your own on your driver's license versus what you sign on a check. They often don't look the same. And it's hard for somebody, third party, to look at that and identify you by that.
Yeah, well, there's always the balance of, okay, ID, you're saying, may solve that problem, but it may also disenfranchise folks in the meantime, and I know that's something you guys are working to
avoid. And that's why we extended the implementation of House Bill 300 and why we're giving free state ID. We don't want to disenfranchise anyone. In fact, we want to encourage everybody that can vote to vote. And so the free ID is going to help significantly in that way.
Representative Jeff Burton, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it. Lots of issues to keep our eyes on, so we appreciate it. Well, coming up here on Inside Utah Politics, could the U.S. join the war in Iran? How that question is splitting both parties in Congress next. Well, Washington is split over whether the U.S. military should step in to help Israel's offensive operations in Iran. Israel has been lobbying for more U.S. support, saying only the U.S. has the 30,000-pound, quote, bunker buster bomb capable of reaching Iran's deeply buried nuclear site. Now, President Trump says he's keeping his options open and hasn't decided how to move forward. Congress is split, and that split doesn't necessarily neatly fall along party lines.
I don't want to see there be a Mideast war. I don't want the United States to be involved in it. I don't want to see us be bombing.
The president may well authorize a limited bombing strike to take out that one nuclear weapons facility in the basement of a mountain Fordo. And if he does so, it will make Americans substantially safer.
Well, members of both parties, including Democratic Senator Tim Kaine and Republican Congressman Thomas Massie, have called for a war powers resolution to block President Trump from using U.S. military force against Iran without a vote in Congress. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court upholding a Tennessee law banning gender-affirming care for transgender minors. Now, critics of the law argue it discriminates on the basis of sex, but in a 6-3 decision authored by Chief Justice John Roberts, the court found the law did not violate the equal protection provisions of the 14th Amendment. Justice Sonia Sotomayor sharply criticizing, disagreeing with that, saying, quote, the majority abandons transgender children and their families to political whims. Now, Tennessee is one of two dozen states with laws that ban all gender-affirming care for minors, including puberty blockers and hormone therapy. But Utah is one of those states with some form of ban in these treatments in place. But Utah's law passed back in 2023, then known as SB 16. It banned all the same procedures with a slight carve-out for patients already receiving care before February of 2023. Now, another difference is the enforcement. Utah's law made it so doctors prescribing these treatments could be sanctioned for malpractice. And the Tennessee law went further, or rather, they couldn't be sanctioned. The Tennessee law went further, allowing parents to sue doctors and allowing the attorney general to criminally prosecute them. Well, the American Civil Liberties Union of Utah calls the ruling a devastating loss for transgender people and their families. But they note that the court limited this ruling to its facts, meaning more existing cases protecting trans rights will stand and more lawsuits could be coming. Well, the state of Utah is celebrating a win over the EPA at the Supreme Court. The high court ruled 8-0 this week that local courts, not the D.C. Circuit Court, will be in charge of ruling on violations of the Clean Air Act under what's called the Good Neighbor Rule. Now, this rule basically requires that states cut down on pollution that might lower air quality in neighboring states. The Utah Attorney General and Solicitor General call it a win for local control.
A state plan is just that. It is a state-specific plan of how Utah complied with the Clean Air Act. And when EPA denied that plan, it was, by definition, a locally applicable decision because it applied to Utah.
Well, critics of the ruling argue that this essentially allows for venue shopping, where the states can find a friendlier audience for their arguments than they'd get in Washington. Well, that's going to do it for today's Inside Utah Politics. Don't forget, if you have any local political stories you'd like to see, make sure to reach out. You can email InsideUtahPolitics@abc4.com. Also, follow me on social media, X, Blue Sky Threads, Lindsay On Air, Lindsay spelled with an A, on Instagram as well. You can also find our show online in podcast form, wherever you podcast. Just search for Inside Utah Politics with Lindsay Ertz. Thanks for being with us, everyone. We will see you next week.